are my neighbors. Tune in to Out There to meet some of them. Out There airs every Wednesday from 4 to 5 in the afternoon with me, Ruthie Woodring. Come with me and my recorder to meet people and plants and think about ways we can share the world. That's Out There every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. here on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP, 103.3 FM, Northampton. Archived editions of Out There are online at weatherbeard.com/RUTHY. Get out if you can. But if you can't get out, tune in. And that's now. I'm live in the studio here, Ruthie Woodring with Dwayne Rainey. Thanks for coming in, Dwayne.
I like robot Ruthie.
I finally got that promo together to put on the computer. So today's show, Wednesday from 4 to 5, here we are. Today's show, I'm really, really discombobulated. I could not get it together. And I was going to play a rerun, but I couldn't even get it together to do that. I have some music. I have some short clips. I do have quite a few short clips. And you know what? I'm going to start out by just announcing my friend Eli Damon's Cycling Savvy class coming up in June.
It will be in Amherst, June 26th and 27th, and it will be all about how to feel confident riding a bike anywhere you want to go. It's $75, and you can register at register.cyclingsavvy.org.
And I just want to personally say that I took Eli's class last year, and even though I consider myself a very confident cyclist, his class was a really important thing for me to help myself become more comfortable existing as a cyclist in a really car-centric culture, and to have less of that, you know, monkey on my back about thinking, oh no, I'm delaying someone. So I really encourage people who want to, whether you're a beginning cyclist or an experienced cyclist, Eli's class is good for all levels. And cyclingsavvy.org is a website that can
register.
Where you can register or just learn more about it. Actually, the Cycling Savvy website has a lot of really good information about bike safety and a lot of really good videos, mostly from Orlando, a lot of four-lane roads in Orlando. A lot of good videos about traffic flow and traffic patterns and why it makes sense to ride with the traffic instead of off to the side.
I seen a good one yesterday in Cycling Humor.
Where the
bicycle lane
thing
was just said cars only, and the rest of the road was like lane for bicycles. That was great.
A multi-lane highway,
yes,
and the lanes are all bike lanes.
Cycling Humor.
So here's another short little clip I have. Do you know what this is the sound of? Carpenter bees. But don't worry, they don't actually sting. So, I wanted to say a few things about carpenter bees. According to my research on the computer and my personal experience, no, they don't sting. You know, they chew holes in the side of your
garages.
Yeah, our soffit is full of holes that are about bumblebee width and anywhere from an inch to 4 or 5 inches long. But the research I did says that it's mostly superficial. Then the woodpeckers come, and then they peck out the larva. Here, I want to read this from an online site, pollinator.com. It says that the drone carpenter bee, and there's a nice picture of it, it's got a white spot. He's got a white spot on his head. It says, some folks are terrified of this buzzer. You won't see him visiting flowers and minding his own business like the female. Rather, he'll be looking you over to see if you are sexy. Drones have a territory that they watch, and anything within it that moves will be investigated. But there's not an ounce of aggression in this harmless fellow's body, except towards other drones. He can't sting you anyway. So when he comes to buzz around you, look him straight in the eye and dance with him. Toss a pebble and watch him chase it. Look cross-eyed or stick out your tongue at him. See, all he'll do is a friendly buzz game. This is an ideal chance to teach your kids one of the joys of nature, rather than load them up with wasted fear of something completely harmless. Anyway, so there's my little plug for carpenter bees as pollinators.
Yes, but also give your children bee education so they don't do it with, like, hornets. Look them in the eye.
And so then, I guess the female carpenter bee can possibly sing, but you've really got to threaten her. And in terms of their pollination, I read on Wikipedia that they're sometimes called, I think, pollen larcenists, because for some kinds of flowers, they can steal the nectar without pollinating, but they are important pollinators of other kinds of flowers. I think it's because they drill a hole into the corolla and suck out the nectar sometimes, depending on how open the flower is. They don't always, you know, get the fluff on their stuff and transport it around. let's see. What's next? So here's something else I have. Last week, Alex did a piece on this walk that he did from Florence to Vermont and back. And so I've been thinking about walking and people who walk. And there's someone that walks on the rail trail that I see quite often.
Yes.
Yes. An old friend of Duane's.
Yes, she is.
Yeah.
Great person.
Yeah, Sandy. I think I first met Sandy when, like, she would bring... She would bring her recycling up to my house. Because at that time, they didn't have recycling at Meadowbrook. All they had was trash dumpsters. And everybody else had recycling. Finally, they got recycling. But until they got recycling, like every week, every couple of weeks, she'd bring a couple of little shopping bags of her recycling up to my house and ask me if I could take it for her, which I thought was really sweet for her to go to that extra effort to save that out. Anyway.
She had a knee operation.
But she gets around. All right, here's Sandy in her own words. This is Duane and I ran into her on the path yesterday.
Where are you walking from right now?
Oh, just off Florence Center. I was going to walk down to Stop and Shop later on, you know.
Uh-huh.
It'd take me 45 minutes. Yeah, me and my sister, we walk over the Halley Bridge one. It takes about 2 hours and 15 minutes.
So, how old are you?
I'm 65.
Uh-huh.
65.
And have you always walked a lot?
Yeah, I walk a lot, yeah. But I walk a lot more now.
Now, like, what? When did you start walking more?
A couple years ago.
Was it when you were recovering from your surgery?
Yeah, a knee replacement.
A knee replacement, uh-huh. How is it walking with your walker long distances?
Oh, yeah, it helped me out.
Yeah, yeah.
Because otherwise, I mean...
yeah, because you go miles with this thing. Yeah. I just think it's really cool that you take this thing from Florence
I go over the tracks with it. Yeah, right. Over the track. They cut that where they got a fence in Walgreens.
By Walgreens, uh-huh.
They cut it or something. You ever go over the
track? Oh, that's the way. Yeah, of course. That's where I go across. That's the only way to get across.
That's the only way to get across. To get to the other two bike trail.
You want to get a Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah.
But, like, especially if you're with a walker, to have to use a sidewalk and go all around, it's especially difficult.
Yeah, I love the bike trail. You can get around good because sometimes if they're bumped, your walker would tip.
Yeah.
You know? But I like to walk with this. It helped me out a lot.
Yeah. Do you ever just stop and take a break and sit on the
seat? No, I never sit down. No, yeah. I don't get, you know, sometimes I don't get. I have to rush down, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, we walk back there. We left the mall about, sometimes we leave at 6 and get, we don't, it takes us 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Back from the mall.
When you're walking at night, do you have any concerns about, I don't know, lights or?
That bike trail is kind of dark. Kind of nervous about, you know, somebody said there could be coyote. Is there, you ever see anything on their bike trail?
No, I mean, they're so afraid of human beings.
Are they?
Wild animals are, yeah, bears and everything. So, no, I love it at night. I like
having a place to I would love at night to walk, but not by myself.
Uh-huh.
What do you got?
A light.
Yeah, could you put it on here?
Yeah, I can.
Hey.
Now.
Dang. Oh, yeah. Oh, it fit right on the walker.
I always tell you, get a light.
Oh, yeah, and we do. Thank you, Duane. And now I could go out and end up by you at night.
Just walking at night, I'm always saying, you need a light for that thing.
That was Sandy. She and her sister Barbara often walk in the trail. Do I say anything, Duane?
Oh, yes, they do. I see him walking everywhere. I seen it one time, I had to take it and say, hey, get off the trail, because they had a beach ball they found out by Stop and Shop. It must have blown away from some kids or something. And they were at that little Y section, as one goes down to State Street, and then the other keeps going, and they were bouncing the beach ball back and forth right in the middle of the traffic. Get out of the way.
All right, well, the next random clip I have is from the Valley Time Trade 5th anniversary party. That was last Saturday, and here's Morty.
My name is Morty, and I got involved in Valley Time Trade by going to a housing law conference that Edgar Kahn was the speaker. And I went up to him afterwards, and he said, "You have a time trade here in the Valley." And I went, and I looked it up, and I joined. And at that point, Jennifer Ladd was on the core committee, and she was really enthusiastic, and she got me involved. And that was, gosh, almost 4 years ago, and I've been trading ever since.
Who is the man you just mentioned at the housing law conference?
Edgar Kahn. He's the person who actually started time trading back 30-some-odd years ago.
Oh, wow. Okay. How does Valley Time Trade work? Like, say if I want to become a member, what happens?
If you have a service or something that you are offering to the community, then you go to the website. After you get your orientation and become a member, you go to the website, and you put that service online. So another one, just as an example, if you're willing to drive people to medical appointments. And when you drive someone to a medical appointment, then the time that you spend doing that gets banked to your account. And you now have that time to spend on a service that you need. So one of the things that I do, I'm a retired physician, and one of the things that I do is that I advocate for patients. And if a patient has questions about a medical procedure, then I try and answer those questions. And so you can drive someone to the doctor and then come back, see the doctor yourself, and say, "I don't understand what the doctor just said to me. I think I'm going to call Morty." And talk to him about what the doctor just said to me. So that's, and because it's not a barter, because it's not two items of equal value changing hands between two people, but it's between three people, and it's time-based rather than quote-unquote value-based, it's not taxable. So it's outside of the regular economy.
What kinds of services have you used?
Oh, my goodness. Right now, I've just had someone stay in my home and look after my two babies, my doggie and my cat, for a week. I've had people who have driven me to the airport. I've had people who have walked my dogs. And I've had help in my garden.
So this is an hour-for-hour system. Everyone's time is the same. I kind of feel like all hours aren't the same, you know, because like once I did it, because I'm a member of Valley Time Trade, and once I did a couch moving job on a bike trailer, like it was like a 5 miles of a couch on a bike trailer that took me like an hour. That was a hard hour. It was a lot harder than the hour here sitting around doing some bike repair. You have any thoughts on that?
In every single economy, there are going to be some inequities. Okay? I look at the economy that we actually live in, what people refer to as the real world, and I'm disgusted literally every single day. So, yes, there are going to be some unfairnesses. Yes, someone walking a dog for an hour isn't as well trained as I am when I provide a legal service to someone for an hour. But it's both an hour out of our lives. And I don't see why the legal service should be valued at that different a place than the person who's providing what I consider to be a valuable service to me that I can't do. So, yeah, there might be some inequities, But there, I think there's far less inequities in this system than there are in the real world.
Cool. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I just love Valley Time Trade.
Well, thanks for your time, and thanks for your work with Valley Time Trade.
All right.
So my name is Jessica Tanner. I live in Northampton, and I've been a Valley Time Trade member for almost 4 years now. When I moved to Northampton, I wanted to become Time Bank member. I'd been a Time Bank member up in Burlington, Vermont, as well as Brattleboro, Vermont previously, and I just love the idea. My favorite thing about it is the fact that everyone's time is equal. So, you know, someone who's a doctor, their time is equal to my time or a hairdresser's time. I just love that concept. And I've been able to benefit by meeting a lot of new folks. You know, when you're new in a community, it's hard to make friends, and so I was able to meet a lot of fabulous people through Valley Time Trade. I love gardening, so I've offered gardening help to other folks. I make community videos, so I offered to make like a Reiki instructor video, and Stan the Fix-It Man wanted a dog training video, promotional video made, and so I did that. Of course, it's easier to talk about the things that we like to offer versus the things that we receive, but I found different classes that were great, like online research, and a graphic artist designed a business card for me. I enjoyed some Reiki sessions.
You know, that reminds me, I got a Valley Time Trade session of live coaching, which is how the whole thing that led to me having this radio show right now.
Oh, great. I hear people all the time saying, oh, I don't have time to become a Valley Time Trade member. You know, I wouldn't be able to find the people to trade with, and I just don't have time to meet with people. But the way I see it, I'm saving time by having people help me with all these projects, and I'm saving money because I didn't have to pay for someone to design that business card. So you're potentially saving hundreds of dollars every year, and you're building community and you're meeting new folks. So to me, it's a win-win-win situation.
Do you know how many people are members right now, and how broad geographically is the membership?
I think we're at least at 400 members, but yeah, that is a dispersed population around the Pioneer Valley. So our major pockets are Greenfield, Amherst, and Northampton. So anyone interested in becoming a Valley Time Trade member, just go to valleytimetrade.org. You can look at the calendar and see when orientations are going to be happening. To become a member, you need to, you can fill out the online application, which is really short and quick, and then you'll get an email reminder to attend an orientation. And at the orientation, you'll learn how to use the software, which is how we record trades. And by the end of the orientation, you'll be a member.
You've been listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. That was just an interview with Jessica Tanner. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. This next thing is, this is David Aguilar, La Cumbia de la Bicicleta, trying to get some bike lanes in Mexico City.
Cada giro de la estrella le da cuerda a la paciencia en la resistencia ante el flujo vial. Tal vez lo más progresista pueda ser lo más sencillo, cual dos tobillos sobre un pedal. Cuando la ciudad va llena, una noble maquinaria en la vida diaria podrá ayudar. Y es un cuadro equilibrado y que se echa a andar tan solo con los alveolos al respirar. Te hallaré pedaleando en el viaje de allá para acá, que nos vayan dejando un carril para nosotros ya. Puede darte varios cambios, del manubrio a los pedales hay muchos males por reducir. Siempre hay estacionamiento, matas el estrés un rato y es más barato, dímelo a mí. Vámonos bajando panza, vámonos librando venas con la cadena que hace fluir. Vámonos al teatro en bici, a la chamba y a la escuela, hasta el bicinema o hasta de aquí. Te hallaré pedaleando en el viaje de allá para acá, que nos vayan dejando un carril para nosotros ya. Anda en bici la banda, porque
que tiene su qué sé yo, cada vez más demanda, porque es mágica, poco no. Ya súbase a la bici, compa, trépese a la de montaña, la bici urbana, la bici cross. Lléguele a la bicicleta, ya de menos a la eléctrica o a la estática, ya no hay tos. Llegaré pedaleando en el viaje de allá para acá, que nos vayan dejando un carril pa' nosotros ya. Anda en bici la banda, porque tiene su qué sé yo, cada vez más demanda, porque es mágica, poco no. Cumbia para las biclas que nos mueven de allá pa' acá, a ver si ya reciclan un carril pa' nosotros ya.
That song about bikes reminded me of a story a week or two ago. I was riding down State Street towards downtown Northampton, and this car, this SUV, passed me really close, you know, like a foot away. I felt like I was buzzed. And so as they went on by, I sort of waved my left hand up in the air and out a little bit, like, hey, can you give me some more room? And then the driver, By this time, they were probably 30 or 40 yards away, stuck his arm out the window and gave me the finger. And I heard something like, go to the sidewalk. And they kept on going straight towards the light downtown. And I was like, okay, maybe I can catch him. So I rode really fast. And sure enough, I caught him at the light by Edwards Church. And I pulled up in the passenger side window, which was open. There was a woman in the passenger seat and a man in the driver's seat. And I looked in at the driver and I said, did you tell me to get on the sidewalk? And he said, yeah, because you're in the middle of the road. And I said, well, it's safer for me to be in this, you know, in the road. The sidewalk's kind of a dangerous place to be. And like when you pass, you should give a cyclist at least 3 feet. And I held out my arms to show him what 3 feet was. And he said, but I couldn't get past you because there was a car coming in the other direction. And I said, well, then like with any slow moving vehicle, like if I was a tractor or whatever, you just have to wait your turn until it's clear. And he said, yeah, but you need to shave.
What a comeback.
Anyway, I thought it was pretty funny. Dwayne, you got an announcement?
I sure do. Hoya Career Closet is seeking donations of professional clothing and its mission to provide folks in need with attire needed for job interviews. Gently used new professional men's and women's clothing such as suits, blazers, blouses, collared shirts, pants, skirts, sweaters, and dress coats are sought. The Career Closet is a collaboration between Providence Ministry Service Network and Holyoke Community College. Professional clothing donations may be brought to the Providence Ministry Service Network at 51 Hamilton Street. I guess that would be in Holyoke, Mass. Also. From 9 till 4, or you can call them at 536-9109.
Every day in the electronic media, people talk, or more likely yell, about politics.
We do things differently.
Our job is to talk about the things that we hope will be of interest to you without all the shouting and anger.
We hope to provide facts and have reasonable discussions about the issues of the day.
That is to disagree without being disagreeable.
Join us every Friday at 7 p.m. for Civil Politics here on WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton, or anytime online at civilpoliticsradio.wordpress.com.
Sundays at 10 a.m., WXOJ's radio show, Occupy the Airwaves, has the latest news from the occupation movement, locally, regionally, nationally, and around the planet. Tune in at 103.3 FM or webcasting at www.valleyfreeradio.org. Blogging at occupytheairwaves.wordpress.com. Listeners can call into the show at 413-585-1033.
So welcome back to Out There.
What do you got there, Ruthie?
So next I have, this is something that was sent to me, from an email list that I'm on. It's an article entitled, Why It's So Hard to Talk to White People About Racism, from the Good Men Project. It's about why it's so hard for white people to talk to white people about racism. And it's written by Robin DiAngelo, who's a professor at Westfield State, and he's, I think it's a he. Somehow I thought it was a he. First I thought it was a she, but anyway. So I hope it's okay to read some of this, because Dr. DiAngelo puts it great. So Dr. DiAngelo says, I am white. I've spent years studying what it means to be white in a society that proclaims race meaningless yet is deeply divided by race. And this is what I've learned. Any white person living in the United States will develop opinions about race simply by swimming in the water of our culture. But mainstream sources, schools, textbooks, media, don't provide us with the multiple perspectives we need. Yes, we will develop strong, emotionally laden opinions, but they will not be informed opinions. Our socialization renders us racially illiterate. When you add a lack of humility to that illiteracy, because we don't know what we don't know, you get the breakdown we so often see when trying to engage white people in meaningful conversations about race. Mainstream dictionary definitions reduce racism to individual racial prejudice and the intentional actions that result. The people that commit these intentional acts are deemed bad, and those that don't are good. If we are against racism and unaware of committing racist acts, we can't be racist. Racism and being a good person have become mutually exclusive. But this definition does little to explain how racial hierarchies are consistently reproduced. Social scientists understand racism as a multidimensional and highly adaptive system, a system that ensures an unequal distribution of resources between racial groups. Because whites build and dominate all significant institutions, often at the expense of and on the uncompensated labor of other groups, their interests are embedded in the foundation of U.S. society. And while individual whites may be against racism, they still benefit from the distribution of resources controlled by their group. He's totally talking about me here. Yes, an individual person of color can sit at the tables of power, but the overwhelming majority of decision makers will be white. Yes, white people can have problems and face barriers, but systematic racism won't be one of them. This distinction between individual prejudice and a system of unequal institutionalized racial power is fundamental. One cannot understand how racism functions in the U.S. today if one ignores group power relations. This systemic and institutional control allows those of us who are white in North America to live in a social environment that protects and insulates us from race-based stress. We've organized society to reproduce and reinforce our racial interests and perspectives. And further, we're centered in all matters deemed normal, universal, benign, neutral, and good. Thus, we move through a wholly racialized world with an unracialized identity. For example, white people can represent all of humanity. People of color can only represent their racial selves. Challenges to this identity become highly stressful and even intolerable. The following are examples of the kinds of challenges that trigger racial stress for white people. Again, I'm reading from an article entitled, Why It's So Hard to Talk to White People About Racism, by Robin DiAngelo. Okay, so these are some examples of the kinds of challenges that trigger racial stress for white people. Suggesting that a white person's viewpoint comes from a racialized frame of reference, that is like challenged objectivity. Or people of color talking directly about their own racial perspectives, which could be a challenge to white taboos of talking openly about race. Or people of color choosing not to protect the racial feelings of white people in regards to race. That's a challenge to white racial expectations and need or entitlement to racial comfort. Or people of color not being willing to tell their stories or answer questions about their racial experiences. That's a challenge to the expectation that people of color will serve us. Or a fellow white not providing agreement with one's racial perspective. That's a challenge to white solidarity. or receiving feedback that one's behavior had a racist impact. It's a challenge to white racial innocence. Again, these are examples of the kinds of challenges that trigger racial stress for white people. A few more here, four more here. Suggesting that group membership is significant, which is a challenge to individualism. Or an acknowledgement that access is unequal between racial groups, which is a challenge to meritocracy. Or being presented with a person of color in a position of leadership, which is a challenge to white authority. Or being presented with information about other racial groups through, for example, movies in which people of color drive the action but are not in stereotypical roles. Or multicultural education, which is a challenge to white centrality. So the author says, not often encountering these challenges, we white people withdraw, defend, cry, argue, minimize, ignore, and in other ways push back to regain our racial position and equilibrium. I term that pushback white fragility. This concept came out of my ongoing experience leading discussions on race, racism, white privilege, and white supremacy with primarily white audiences. It became clear over time that white people have extremely low thresholds for enduring any discomfort associated with challenges to our racial worldviews. Sorry, I lost my place. We can manage the first round of challenge by ending the discussion through platitudes, usually something that starts with, people just need to this, or race doesn't really have any meaning to me, or everybody's racist. Scratch any further on that surface, however, and we fall apart. Socialized into a deeply internalized sense of superiority and entitlement that we are either not consciously aware of or can never admit to ourselves, we become highly fragile in conversations about race. We experience a challenge to our racial worldview as a challenge to our very identities as good moral people. It also challenges our sense of rightful place in the hierarchy. Thus, we perceive any attempt to connect us to the system of racism as a very unsettling and unfair moral offense. The following patterns make it difficult for white people to understand racism as a system and lead to the dynamics of white fragility. While they do not apply to every white person, they are well documented overall. So there's three. So I think these are the following are like the 10 points that the author is going to make. Segregation. So most whites live, grow, play, learn, love, work, and die primarily in social and geographic racial segregation. Yet our society does not teach us to see this as a loss. Pause for a moment and consider the magnitude of this message. We lose nothing of value by having no cross-racial relationships. In fact, the wider our schools and neighborhoods are, the more likely they are to be seen as good. The implicit message is that there is no inherent value in the presence or perspectives of people of color. Excuse me. This is an example of the relentless messages of white superiority that circulate all around us, shaping our identities and worldviews. Number two, the good-bad binary. The most effective adaptation of racism over time is the idea that racism is conscious bias held by mean people. If we're not aware of having negative thoughts about people of color, and we don't tell racist jokes, and we're nice people, and we even have friends of color, then we cannot be racist. Thus, the person is either racist or not racist. If a person is racist, that person is bad. If a person is not racist, that person is good. Although racism does, of course, occur in individual acts, these acts are part of a larger system that we all participate in. The focus on individual incidences prevents the analysis that is necessary in order to challenge this larger system. The good-bad binary is the fundamental misunderstanding driving white defensiveness about being connected to racism. We simply do not understand how socialization and implicit bias work. And number three, individualism. Whites are taught to see themselves as individuals rather than as part of a racial group. Individualism enables us to deny that racism is structured into the fabric of society, and this erases our history and hides the way in which wealth has accumulated over generations and benefits us as a group today. It also allows us to distance ourselves from the history and actions of our group. Thus, we get very irate when we are accused of racism because as individuals, We are different from other white people and expect to be seen as such. We find intolerable any suggestion that our behavior or perspectives are typical of our group as a whole. Speaking for myself as radio show host, I have been a recipient of some passed down wealth, which has always made me a little uncomfortable, but what have I done about it? I'm working on it. Okay, so number four, entitlement to racial comfort. In the dominant position, whites are almost always racially comfortable and thus have developed unchallenged expectations to remain so. We've not had to build tolerance for racial discomfort, and thus, when racial discomfort arises, whites typically respond as if something is wrong and blame the person or event that triggered the discomfort, usually a person of color. This blame results in a socially sanctioned array of responses towards a perceived source of the discomfort, including penalization, retaliation, isolation, and refusal to continue engagement. Since racism is necessarily uncomfortable and that it is oppressive, white insistence on racial comfort guarantees racism will not be faced except in the most superficial of ways. Racial arrogance. Most whites have a very limited understanding of racism because we've not been trained to think in complex ways about it, and because it benefits white dominance not to do so. Yet we have no compunction about debating the knowledge of people who have thought complexly about race. Whites generally feel free to dismiss these informed perspectives rather than have the humility to acknowledge that they are unfamiliar, reflect on them further, or seek more information. Actually, I want to go back to the other point that the author was making about entitlement to racial comfort and how, racism is necessarily uncomfortable and that it's oppressive. And just like speaking for myself on this radio show, I try to bring up issues of racism sometimes, but it is more difficult for me emotionally, psychologically, than talking about, you know, bicycling or something like that. So, and I can, it's like I have the luxury to choose to not talk about it if I don't want to. Okay, so next, racial belonging. Oh, by the way, I want to say, if anyone wants to call in and has comments, you can call the studio at 585-1033. Okay, so racial belonging. White people enjoy a deeply internalized, largely unconscious sense of racial belonging in a U.S. society. In virtually any situation or image deemed valuable in dominant society, whites belong. The interruption of racial belonging is rare and thus destabilizing and frightening to whites and usually avoided. The next is psychic freedom. Because race is constructed as residing in people of color, whites don't bear the social burden of race. We move easily through our society with a sense of ourselves as racialized, without a sense of ourselves as racialized. Race is for people of color to think about. It's what happens to them. They can bring it up if it's an issue for them. Although if they do, we can dismiss it as a personal problem, the race card, or the reason for their problems. This allows whites much more psychological energy to devote to other issues and prevents us from developing the stamina to sustain attention on an issue as charged and uncomfortable as race. The next thing is constant messages that we are more valuable. So living in a white dominant context, we receive constant messages that we are better and more important than people of color. For example, our centrality in history textbooks, historical representations and perspectives, our centrality in media and advertising, our teachers, role models, heroes and heroines, everyday discourse on good neighborhoods and good schools and who is in them, popular TV shows centered around friendship circles that are all white, religious iconography that depicts God, Adam, and Eve, and other key figures as white. While one may explicitly reject the notion that one is inherently better than another, one cannot avoid internalizing the message of white superiority, as it is ubiquitous in mainstream culture. The Black Lives Matter is a... I'm really glad that I hear that again and again to try and counteract some of the messages. Okay, so I'm reading from an article, Why It's So Hard to Talk to White People About Racism, by Dr. Robin DiAngelo of Westfield State University. And the author says, these privileges and the white fragility that results prevent us from listening to or comprehending the perspectives of people of color and bridging cross-racial divides. The antidote to white fragility is ongoing and lifelong and includes sustained engagement, humility, and education. Here's some ways that we can begin. By being willing to tolerate the discomfort associated with an honest appraisal and discussion of our internalized superiority and racial privilege. By challenging our own racial reality by acknowledging ourselves as racial beings with a particular and limited perspective on race. By attempting to understand the racial realities of people of color through authentic interaction rather than through the media or unequal relationships. By taking action to address our own racism, the racism of other whites, and the racism embedded in our institutions. Get educated and act. Getting it when it comes to race and racism challenges our very identities as good white people. It's an ongoing and often painful process of seeking to uncover our socialization at its very roots. It asks us to rebuild this identity in new and often uncomfortable ways. But I can testify that it's also the most exciting, powerful, intellectually stimulating, and emotionally fulfilling journey I've ever undertaken. It has impacted every aspect of my life, personal and professional. I have a much deeper and more complex understanding of how society works. I can challenge much more racism in my daily life, and I've developed cherished and fulfilling cross-racial friendships I did not have before. Let me clarify. This is the author, Robin DiAngelo, speaking. I hope that I can, that me, Ruthie, the radio show host, can get to that place. Dr. DiAngelo says, I do not expect racism to end in my lifetime, and I know that I continue to have problematic racist patterns and perspectives. Yet I am also confident that I do less harm to people of color than I used to. This is not a minor point of growth, for it impacts my lived experience and that of the people of color who interact with me. If you are white, I urge you to take the first step. Let go of your racial certitude and reach for humility. Again, that's Why It's So Hard to Talk to White People About Racism from The Good Men Project, written by Dr. Robin DiAngelo, Associate Professor of Critical, Multicultural, and Social Justice Education at Westfield State University. And that article is online if you want to see it. I think if you go to The Good Men Project, if you look up The Good Men Project in a web search, you can probably find it. And you've been listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. Yeah, I have a something that I think of like, I'll call it racism, that I noticed in myself this morning. I don't know if it's, well, anyway, race-related prejudice, stereotyping. So I was looking online at an article about a bunch of shootings and killings that happened in Chicago over the Memorial Day weekend.
12 killed and 44 injured or something? That's the one you're talking about?
Yeah, the one that you had told me about, Duane. And there was a picture, the picture that came up, there was like an emergency vehicle in the background. There was the three men that were in the picture facing the camera. One man, it was a white man on one side, a black man in the middle, and a black man on the other side. So the men on both sides, on the outsides, each of them had the arm of the black man in the middle, and his arms were kind of like, his wrists were kind of together, and they were sort of walking him forward. And my immediate thought was that this was someone that they were arresting for doing the shooting. But if I had taken any kind of care to look at that picture, it would have been really obvious that the emergency vehicle in the background was an ambulance, and that the two people that were had their arm around the man in the middle, the black man in the middle, that they were emergency medical personnel and they were helping a wounded person. So I was really disappointed in my jumping to any kind of conclusion, and I think it's unfortunate that we see so many pictures of black men in the middle of other men, usually cops, that are being arrested.
Or what if he was one of the shooters?
Well, he could have been anybody. All right, so you know what? This is Tracy Chapman.
Don't you know we're talking about a revolution? It sounds like a whisper. Don't you know we're talking about a revolution? It sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds just like, where are people gonna rise up and get their share? Where are people gonna rise up, take what's there? Don't you know you better run, 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 run? Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. It's fine. Talking about a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution. Oh, no. Talking about a revolution. Oh, while they're standing in the welfare lines, crying the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment line, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds whisper. And finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Talking about a revolution, oh, no. Talking about a revolution, oh, no.
That was Tracy Chapman. You've been listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP Northampton, 103.3 FM, and streaming online at valleyfreeradio.org. Democracy Now! Is going to be up in about 10 minutes at 5 o'clock.
So what are you going to do on your vacation?
Well,
then now that everyone's going to find out you're taking a vacation.
I'm going to take my recorder with me to Kentucky when I go to see my family and see if I can make up some good radio shows for when I get back for June. Through the next 3 weeks in June, there's going to be some repeats. Actually, I was hoping to cover, maybe next week, I might do a show about the city's plan to replace all the street lights with LED lights. That's something that the Energy and Sustainability Commission has been discussing. I went to the meeting a couple of weeks ago to see what the plans are. Basically, they're getting this, all the street lights inventoried by a company called Siemens, and then they'll do some trial lights, hopefully enough so that many people get a chance to offer feedback, and then they'll decide where to go from there.
I can't help it. Was anything brought to light during that meeting?
I have an interview with Chris Mason, who's head of the energy, and I forget what his official title is, energy sustainability coordinator or something. But I have an interview with him on Friday, so I'm hoping to get a show together for next week about that. And I'll probably play an interview with James Lowenthal or a good darkness advocate.
She's going to keep it light.
Let's see. Dwayne, so the bike lab every Saturday.
Every Saturday.
You want to learn to fix your bike? How to keep it tuned up so it's there for you when you need it? Or maybe you know already, but you just need to borrow a bike-specific tool that you don't have. Well, come to the Bike Lab.
Almost every Saturday since 2004, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. here in Northampton at 12 Northern Avenue.
Come with your bike or your questions.
And your willing attitude.
Spare parts scavenger hunt every weekend.
Venga para el Bike Lab de Northampton y se divertirá mucho, le enseñará muchas lecciones cómo arreglar bicicletas.
All repairs guaranteed to the end of the driveway.
Details are online at pedalpeople.coop. That's the Saturday Bike Lab at 12 Northern Avenue,
11 a.m. to 2 p.m.
They say freedom isn't free, but at the Bike Lab it is.
Ya súbase a la bici, compa. Trépese a la de montaña, la bici urbana, la bici cross. Lléguele a la bicicleta, ya de menos a la eléctrica o a la estática, ya no hay tos. Llegaré pedaleando en el viaje de allá para acá.
Well.
Anything you want to add to that, Dwayne?
Well, that's the first time I heard that. That was very, very informative.
Oh, thank you. Dwayne and I are usually there, but even though I'll be gone in June, Dwayne or someone else will be there, or Dwayne and or someone else.
I will be there until, well, I'm taking a week off myself.
Here's some Peter, Paul, and Mary.
I dig rock and roll music and I love to get the chance to play.
And sing it.
I figure it's about the happiest sound.
That was Peter, Paul, and Mary. You've been listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. Democracy Now! Is up at 5 o'clock. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Dwayne Rainey, got anything to add?
Have a good vacation, and I'll see you soon.
All right, this is Oda a mi Bicicleta. I don't speak Portuguese, sorry.
Que de los aliados, rambla, calles del Prado. Cuernos de valle, en la ilusión y en el raye, contigo, conté. gran amor, bicicleta.
Well, that sounds Spanish to me. I don't know why I thought it was Portuguese.
Esta canción cumplirá su misión. El día en que la escuche en boca de una chica con voz de miel,
montada en su brillante corcel,
o la silbe un personaje justo antes de que cambie la luz,
montado en su brillante corcel.
Oh, ¿qué será que me inspira? Serán tus rayos que giran. Esta canción cumplirá su misión. El día en que la escuche en boca de una chica con voz de miel,
montada en su brillante corcel.
En boca de una chica todo gotas que realzan la piel,
montada en su brillante corcel.
Como una telaraña que el rocío vistió para cantar,
montada en su brillante corcel.
Y yo voy a olvidarla hasta que vuelva en forma de déjà vu, montado mi oxidado corcel.
Styrofoam, inspected by a French guy named Guillaume. I downshift my Shimano gears, I pedal hard and I'm out of here. Ooh, glad I am that the coast is clear, glad I am to be my bicycle and me. Some Saturdays at 6 a.m. I get up with Bill and Flo in the parking lot of Hojo's west of town. We ride light bikes that cost big bucks. We curse at smelly trucks mile after mile till the sun is almost down. What a ride, what a life. Maybe I'm crazy, don't ask my wife. I've been in love with these spinning wheels since I was maybe three. My bicycle and me. Now
that was Livingston Taylor.